Well, you began to feel the time element beginning to go away when we took the first period and saw the proof, the actual proof of that, appearing with Jesus at the fifth, and the second period, the proof of that appearing with Christian Science at the sixth, and the third period, really, of the children of Israel, really applying to all mankind in the seventh, and of course it all hinges on the fourth, you began to feel the time element, the sequential element, disappearing there, didn't you? It isn't quite the candlestick, is it? Let's look at it just for a moment before we go on as the candlestick, because there's no problem, is there, in seeing the first period coming right across to its complete fulfillment in the seventh. I mean, that's what it's all about. The first has to come to its universal fulfillment in the seventh, and we've already seen the second period of Noah and its relation to Christian Science in the sixth. What about the third period of the children of Israel and the Christian era in the fifth? Can you see a balance taking place there? Because you see the children of Israel are where Judaism has its origins, and in the fifth period of the Christian era, it's where Christianity has its origins, and those two are absolutely essential to each other, because the phrase that has to be used is Judaic Christianity. So you can see the third and the fifth coming into a sort of reciprocity, and of course all hinging on the fourth. So I like to see that, because I can really think then how it's all divinely simultaneous. That's the great thing about it. It isn't a time set up at all. Everything that's taking place there is divinely simultaneous with everything else. Well, you can see that we're using the key to the scriptures, but at the moment we're only using it in the barest outline, but it's essential to use it like that, otherwise we haven't got the hang of the holistic sense of it. But when you turn to the key to the scriptures itself in Science and Health, what do you see, for example, with the days of creation? It isn't just the first day leading to the second day as a whole, leading to the third day as a whole, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh, like that. When you examine the text in the chapter Genesis, what do you find regarding the first day of creation? That it's given to you distinctly in so many subdivisions of the text, isn't it? And how many is it? In three distinct subdivisions of the text. Don't ignore it, for goodness sake, because this is the way the key that you are beginning to use is given to you. So don't, for goodness sake, ignore that. And when you turn to the second day of creation, what do you find there regarding the more detailed appraisal of it? It too is given you in the same number of three subdivisions, or as John Dorley used to call them, the three spiritual tones. Lovely word for it, tones of the second day of creation, the three and the three, and then when you come to the third day of soul and you examine the text there, you find that is presented to you in five distinct subdivisions of the text. That's right. It's a lovely thing, the balance. You see the three followed by a three, leading you to the five of the third day of soul, and then into the fourth day of principle again. How many subdivisions? The text is given you then again in five distinct subdivisions. Am I saying it correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of the text. And then in the fourth day, it's a little, something rather different happens, because the fifth day of creation is presented in simply four subdivisions of the text. That's very interesting. And leading you to the sixth day of creation, as you examine that one, you find that you've got there the full gamut, the full range of the seven tones. That's right. Leading you very simply into the seventh day of creation, where it's only the two. Now, this isn't what anybody's made up. This is the way your beloved, wonderful textbook presents it. So you can't ignore it. And it's absolutely vital that we take it into consideration. You see, there's the first day of mind is given you through mind saying, I am mind, I am spirit, I am soul. Your second day of spirit is where spirit is saying, I am infinite mind, I am infinite spirit, I am infinite soul. Each time it brings you to the point of soul. So that when you come to the third day of soul itself, that's its purpose, to bring you to the third day of soul itself. As soon as you touch the tone of soul, you must come through to life. That's absolutely imperative. And so the third day takes you through from soul, saying, I am mind, I'm spirit, I'm soul, I'm principle, I am life. Five tones in the third day. And the fourth day again takes you up to the point of life. It's principle saying, I am infinite mind, I'm infinite spirit, I'm infinite soul, principle, life. Lovely that, you see, the first two up to the point of soul, then soul itself. The second two up to the point of life, then life itself. That's right. And when you touch the fifth day of life, and you find it in its four distinct tones, and the sixth day of truth in its seven distinct tones, that's pretty marvelous, you see, because now you're really getting to the very heart of the idea, the Christ idea itself, which you are told is where God says, I am incorporeal, divine, supreme, infinite. Those are your four tones, you see, of the fifth day. Incorporeal, divine, supreme, infinite, what? Mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, your seven tones of the sixth day. And that all comes then through to its fulfillment in the two tones of the seventh day. We're all happy about the way in which your 7 days of creation are given to you in your textbook. Therefore, we can't, as I say, ignore it. Because those very tones of the three, followed by the three, followed by the five, by the four, by the seven, and the two, necessarily pertain to your thousand-year periods. They would have to do so, otherwise you're not going to see the one translating, in process of translating the other. So what we must just do for a few minutes is to look at the periods again and the way in which these specific tones apply, period by period, as we see them day by day. So in the first period, you really can't miss it. It's so simple, because you have three main subdivisions of the text, and they're all much of a muchness. It's the mist first of all as the opposite of the first tone. That mist, which is simply mythology, becomes the deep sleep of the cosmic unconscious, the sleep that falls on Adam as the second tone, and the Cain going out into the land of Nod, which is oblivion. So you get the mist, the deep sleep, and the oblivion of the land of Nod. All that disappears in Enoch. But there are your three tones of the first period. Then when you come to the second period of Noah, that is so clear too, because first of all, you have to build your ark. Then you have to get inside that ark and be separate from the destroying flood, what looks like a destroying flood anyway. And then thirdly, you come out from the ark and rebuild your world. Those are the three distinct tones of the second thousand-year period, determined by the three distinct tones of the second day of the firmament, of second day of creation. Then when you come to the third thousand-year period, you see the five very, very obviously, once you really begin to analyze and think about it. The first tone, it's all about the children of Israel, isn't it? And the children of Israel stand for human identity on a world scale. And first of all, in the tone of soul as mind, you see that identity of the children of Israel at the point of origin. That's Abraham, Abraham and Isaac. That's identity at the point of origin, soul as mind. Then when you come to Jacob and Joseph, that same identity has come to the point of actual birth, substantiation, because they're with Jacob are the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, 12 sons anyway. And that is your soul as spirit, soul identity at the point of birth. Then your book of Genesis closes and you enter into Exodus and you start with Moses and you're in the tone of soul as soul. You couldn't have anything more of the absolute nature of identity than when Moses goes up onto Mount Horeb and receives the definition of God as I am that I am, that is pure identity, isn't it? And so the tone at that point is soul as soul itself. And then when Moses after that reduces that law of one I am that I am to a system of the moral law, the tone of principle comes in, and you've reached soul at the point of principle. Finally, in the third period, when you, as a result of that, trek through the wilderness and enter the promised land, you're resurrected not only from Egypt, you're resurrected also from the wilderness, and you're in the land itself, and of course that's a life tone. And it is identity indestructible, its soul as life, identity eternal. So they're very clear there. We will take them in a moment, but I just think we must survey them before we investigate them in more detail or ponder them in a little more detail. When you come to the 4,000-year period, again in its five tones, principle saying, I am infinite mind, what shall govern? What shall govern you? Shall personal sense govern you, or shall principle govern? And you have to choose, in the first book of Samuel, between Saul and David. It's government at the point of origin. Principle's government originating with David, because you have to jettison Saul in the process, which is sheer personal sense. And then in the tone, secondly, of principle as spirit, in the second book of Samuel, of course, it's this beautiful reign of David, which is as in heaven, so on earth. That's your second tone. That's principle as spirit, as in heaven, so on earth. It's the fourth tone of the Lord's Prayer, isn't it? And that's David. That really is David. As in heaven, so on earth. Heaven and earth, one. In the third tone, which is first book of Kings, then you come to the reign of Solomon and the building of the temple. Well, the temple is a symbol of body. And principle as soul, absolutely, is principle's own body. It's principle's own embodiment, principle in its aspect as soul. So in the story, Solomon builds this temple as a symbol of the whole living body of Israel. It's just a symbol of Israel's body, which if she begins to worship it organically, she gets into trouble. That's your principle as soul tone, First Kings. Then, if she allows the kingdom to split in two, that becomes a sex proposition, and that's again the opposite of principle as soul, because the unity of the kingdom is the embodiment of the principle, which isn't a sex proposition at all. So you come then to the fourth tone of the fourth period, which is principle purely as principle, and there you see Elijah ascend up to heaven. Translation, no death at all. And if Israel doesn't obey that, then she'll get taken captive by Assyria and Babylon, and you're in your fourth main tone of the fourth period with principle as principle. Because there's no truth in any of that, it can't last. And so there is the resurrection from that Babylonian situation. And of course, as soon as there's resurrection, you're in your fifth tone of principle as life. And that is Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and the end of your fourth period. Now, when you come to the fifth period, which is now your New Testament or your Christian era, and it's got its four tones, life as mind, of course, that's the four Gospels, that's the mission of Jesus. It's life at the point of origin. I come from the Father, I go back to the Father, I never leave my point of origin. Life as mine, you see that. After the mission of Jesus, of course, it's the Acts of the Apostles. It starts with the day of Pentecost, or the descent of the Holy Ghost, which is spirit as the life of the whole world. And you have the beginnings of the Christian church, the early apostolic church. The tone is life as spirit, where Mrs. Eddy says she discovered Christian Science, life in and of spirit. After what seems like a long period of time, you come to life as soul. You can't miss it. It's because it's there that Rome takes over Christendom and absorbs Christendom into an organic sense of body. You see, whereas the truth about Christendom is life as soul. It's the infinite freedom of individuality in Christianity. That's truly life as soul. The freedom of individuality in Christianity. But if Rome takes it over, you've got a counterfeit sense of that, haven't you? That's all. And fourthly, in that period, you come through to the so-called Dark Ages that we talked about, which is where monasticism begins and the veil descends in your fourth tone of your fifth day of creation. It's all about the veil being lifted, but in the dark ages, and monasticism sets in Christendom, that is when the veil descends. And your fifth period there comes to a close, and you enter your sixth period, called the Christian era, which is basically the story of the Western Christian civilization, which, because of its prodigious output of scientific technology, says to itself, this is going to give me dominion over all the earth. Doesn't Western man say this is what's going to give me dominion over all the earth with his scientific technology? Of course, it doesn't do anything of the sort. It brings him to the point of total self-destruction with the nuclear nuclear explosion and whatnot. But that's the counterfeit, you see, and it's because of the fascination of that for the rest of mankind that the whole world becomes westernized, without exception. But technologically, not culturally. You've got to watch that you don't think of the whole of the rest of the world becoming westernized culturally, because it doesn't. But it does technologically, in terms of the letter. And yes, this is now the sixth period, 6,000-year period, and you see it unfolding through its seven tones of truth as mind. That's Western man at the point of origin begins to think for himself at the opening of the period. Western man at the point of the Renaissance, that's truth as spirit. He brings himself to birth. It's the most wonderful time when he expands and sets out to conquer the globe, and succeeds in doing it too. That's the expansion that you get in truth as spirit. Then, of course, he gets fed up with being in captivity to Rome, and he decides he wants to be free. And so you get him protesting against Roman domination, and the result is the Protestant reformation. It's a reforming, you see, which is truth as soul, because truth as soul is really truth's identity as man himself, the form of man himself. You put it in your own words, of course, when you think about it. And as the outcome of that freedom that comes in the tone of truth as soul, you get an enormous development of democratic government and freedom in every way, and these migrations to the new world of America, so different from the state of affairs in the old world of Europe and the rest of the world. But in America, you see, you have a system of democratic government which the world has never known before. And you're in the tone of truth as principle. From that, you're led to truth as life, which is a period of revolution, and it includes the Industrial Revolution and the French Revolution, the American Revolution leading through to the American Civil War, and it's the machine age, and man getting machines to do the tilling of the soil for him and all that sort of thing. And it's really truth as life that's dominant. And you come to the marvelous moment when the Western society has really unified the world. And not only has the Western society unified the world, but its focus in the United States of America has unified the United States of America. And as the result of the American Civil War, you have the union of all the states. And when that happens, the scene is set. Not before. The scene is set for the Second Advent, and so you come to the Dawn of Truth as truth, and that is the revelation of Christian Science, the science of Jesus's original Christianity. I always think it's a marvelous thing to see that and take your thought then back to when Jesus himself appeared at the opening of the fifth period, Life as Mind, because then it is that the Roman Empire unified the world. The Pax Romana. It had to do that before you could bring Jesus into the picture. Historically, it had to do that. So you get the unifying of the civilized world through the Roman Empire leading to the coming of Christ Jesus. Then you get the unifying of the world by the Western Christian Society leading to the advent of the second aspect of the Messiah Christian Science. You see that? So you come to the, so you're there with the truth as truth, the discovery and founding of Christian Science, and that of course takes us through to where we are today, where the absolute science of that discovery is making its impact. And for the first time you touch the tone of love. Truth is love. It has to be, because nothing is more of the nature of love than that this idea should appear in a form that is universally understandable and acceptable. Doesn't seem to be at the moment, but it's going to be. I mean, it is in absolute truth, it is. And that brings you now to where we are today as the sixth millennium closes and the 20th century closes, and we are on the brink, on the threshold of the seventh millennium. Can you follow that? Too quick, what? Too quick. But you see, don't worry, because next time we'll do that. We have a lovely time just working with those tones, trying to feel the reality of them, to feel the power of them, what they're doing in consciousness, to your and my consciousness and world consciousness. We can have a lovely time. But I just feel we had to outline that before we took. Well, what we want to do now really is to let the story, let the idea unfold, evolve spiritually in a form that is adequate for solving the time problem. And the form we're given for doing this are these respective spiritual tones of the day or the period as one follows the other, the three, the five, the four, the seven, the two, like we've just outlined. And so if we now begin to let that happen, shall we? You already see that the way the Bible opens is the way civilization opens. It's civilized man, so-called, emerging out of primitive man. It's Adam coming out of the mist. That's the parallel. And I just read you one little thing by Toynbee, very short, in his book Civilization on Trial, where he's Arnold Toynbee, you know, this the historian. He says, even if they, our ancestors, were mistaken in believing that the world was created in 4004 BC, as a matter of fact, 4004 BC happens, though our ancestors did not know this, to be quite an important date. It approximately marks the first appearance of representatives of the species of human society called civilizations. The fourth millennium BC sees the emergence of the civilization movement that then unfolds millennium by millennium to the point where we see it today on the brink of fulfilling its purpose in the seventh millennium. You follow that? And what launches it? What launches it? You can call it the spirit of inquiry. Something sets up in human thought that demands to know. It sits there in the fertile crescent and it looks up at the heavens and it sees the glory of the heavens and it sees the miracle of the four seasons taking place in its very midst, and it wants to know why. Wants to know the whys and the wherefores of it. And so miraculous is it that, of course, early civilized man begins to worship the forces that are at work. And you get the deific forces that you find in his mythologies. And so he begins to evolve his mythologies. And as he begins to evolve his mythologies, he begins to measure time. And the reason he does it isn't anything to do with him. It's because time has got to be measured and eventually found to be mythological. So he starts to measure time and so on, and this launches the movement that is known as civilization, which is purely a educational movement. He engages in a movement of self-education. He demands to know. And as he inquires and inquires and gets what he thinks are the answers down through the ages, he'll come through the first period into the second period, it'll develop quite a lot. Into the third period, don't know too much about it, but quite a lot is happening. Into the fourth period, and that is the fulcrum period. That is the so-called classical age of the Greco-Roman civilization. In the Bible, it's the age of Israel's prophets, and the two together related with the fourth day of creation and the term principle, because the Greco-Roman civilization becomes the cradle for all that is to ensue in the world afterwards. All the science and the art and the philosophy and the politics is in embryo in the Greco-Roman civilization that is to come fully to birth and into expression subsequently in the Christian era and the scientific era. And of course the same is true of Israel's prophets. What Israel's prophets are seeing, envisioning, is all that is to take place in the subsequent 5th, 6th and 7th periods. All that the Greco-Roman civilization stands for in the fourth period comes into full comes out into full fruition in the 5th, 6th, and 7th, and as even as it does in the case of Israel's prophets. So the development of the intellectual development in the 4th period is then so enormous, and that goes on, of course, through the 5th and the 6th. But it all starts, historically speaking, there in the 4th millennium BC with the emergence of what we will call the civilization movement itself. Do you see that? Does that make sense? And it starts with the mist. It starts with that went up a mist from the earth. It's the beginnings of time, the beginnings of material evolution. It's that which causes physicists and cosmologists to conceive of the beginnings of the material universe through the Big Bang. It's all myth. It's all myth. But that's where it has its origins, there in that mist. And in the period, the first period itself, your mind as mind tone is where Adam is formed out of that mist. That mist mingled with the dust of the ground, so that you get a nice pudding of mud, called red mud, called Adama. Adam is made out of Adama. Adama is the matrix of Adam. And he's fallen man, of course, Adam. And being fallen man, he's susceptible to animality, so he names the animals because he wants a help meet for himself. He wants something out there. He doesn't know that he is complete in himself. And it's all origin tone, it's mind as mind, it's just the origin of things. And you come to mind as spirit, which is the deep hypnotic sleep inflicted on him. You wouldn't get it without that mist. It's just the next step on from the mist. The deep hypnosis when he dreams that he is in fact cut up sexually into an Adam here and an Eve there. And as soon as he's cut up sexually into an Adam and an Eve, he wants to make the two one again. You see? And this is the dream of mortality, the Adam dream. Now, there's something we really mustn't miss here in this tone of mind as spirit. You see, the beauty of it is that mind knows itself to be spirit. Mind knows that spirit is its own subjective state, and what is objective to it is simply the reflection of its own subjective state as spirit. Whereas Adam and Eve, Adam has his subjective state, which is really Eve, cut away from him, and she appears actually over there, and this is mortality. But here is something which we mustn't miss, and we get it on page 528 of the textbook, where we read how falsity, error, credits truth, God, with inducing a sleep or hypnotic state in Adam. It's your collective unconscious, your cosmic, psychic, unconscious. He sinks right down into the so-called unconscious realm and dreams. Hypnotic state in Adam in order to perform a surgical operation on him and thereby create woman. This, says the text, is the first record of magnetism. Know what he's done just immediately before that? He's identified the animals. He's named the animals. As soon as he's named the animals, magnetism comes in. And it becomes a condition of so-called animal magnetism. Now, that's a pretty grim situation, but for the fact of Christian Science. Because it's when Christian Science comes that that dream of animal magnetism is dispersed. How? How? On page 146, line 31, divine metaphysics is now reduced. See, error, falsity, credits truth God with inducing this hypnotic state. To counter that, divine metaphysics is now reduced to a system, to a comprehensible healing system. And this is the marvelous thing. It was said to be the first surgical operation, this severing of the rib. And the surgical definition of the word reduce is the key to it. Because to reduce is to restore dislocated parts. Now you see, in the dream, not only is man dislocated from God, fallen man, but as the corollary to that, Eve is dislocated from Adam, and female is dislocated from male in the dream, in the mortal dream, all the dream stuff. You see, now, how marvelous then that the reduction of divine metaphysics to a comprehensible system adapted to and comprehensible by the age in which we live. This system is literally speaking to us. It's literally on our doorstep. It's literally making itself felt. It's literally becoming of the nature of consciousness to us, of the nature of life to us, so that when we look into the depths of it, you see that there never was any dislocation. Everything is held in place in its divine principle. The rhythm, the harmony, the beauty, the order, you see, doesn't permit for anything like a surgical operation. And so the system is that, the divine system is that which restores all things to their divine principle. Doesn't really restore it, you see. It simply is the consciousness that everything is in place and can't ever be removed from its place in principle. Do we see that? Can you see the wonder of it? This is Christian Science as it truly is. And as such, you see, it is nothing less than the answer to the original mythological mist becoming the deep hypnotic sleep, becoming the oblivion of the land of Nod. It's nothing less than that. Therefore, to appraise it in this way, you've wiped out the Big Bang. You've wiped out the fall of Lucifer. You've wiped out the possibility of a nuclear holocaust. Because the nuclear center of being, which is God and man, man and woman, it has not been touched. Has never been disrupted. Nothing has ever been dislocated. The nuclear center has never been divided. It's indivisible. And this is the marvel, you see, of seeing that our first period has got the whole answer there. And unless we see this, we can't really logically move on to the eventual proof, demonstration, and fulfillment of it. And it really is here by implication in the very first period of all. What do you think of that? So you come through to the mind as soul, and this is where Cain has murdered Abel, and in consequence he's banished to oblivion. Because of the murderous nature of mortality, mortality is banished into oblivion, and Adam and Eve say, enough's enough, I'm going to start again. There's nothing for it but to rethink the whole situation. And so they start from the spiritual standpoint, which is Seth, and then it begins to resolve. Starting with Seth, the seven generations from Adam through Seth to Enoch follow the order of the 7 days of creation, and the problem solved. Enoch is translated, you see, that he should not see death. And then, as we said before, you get the 4 generations from Enoch to Noah. Well, I don't know, could you accept that there lies the essential gist of the first period? What it really has got for us. It isn't theory, you see, it's very real in terms of idea. So let's come to the second period in its 3 tones, spirit as mind, spirit and soul, and it's the story of Noah. This same shall comfort us. Love that, don't you? This same shall comfort us. The Noah story is the picture of today. The earth is filled with violence before me and corruption, God says. That's today. In belief, in true. But it's the same as the Noah story. And all flesh has to be destroyed. Sounds pretty grim, doesn't it? But it doesn't mean that anything's going to be destroyed. It simply means that the belief that substance is matter, that substance is flesh instead of spirit, that's going to be destroyed. Of course it is. But that's nothing actual being destroyed. And his 3 sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, from whom all nations of the earth derive. It's extraordinary, you see, really, when you begin to when you begin to survey it in the civilization begins in the Fertile Crescent. You have three distinct societies: the Egyptian, the Sumerian, and the Minoan. In the first period of Adam, you have three distinct sons: Cain, Abel, Seth. And this is the parallel. Come into the second period of Noah, and you have three sons again: Ham, Shem, Japheth. Of course, it's the 3 degrees: physical, the moral, the spiritual. So let's just very briefly take the tone: spirit as mind. Build yourself an ark. What are you going to do with this threat of destruction? You must build yourself an ark of spiritual understanding. You see, the world is going to be flooded. Now, that's not a negative thing at all. What it's going to be flooded with is the baptism of spirit. It's the baptism of spirit that's going to swallow up or destroy the belief in fleshly substance. You see, belief that matter is substance. It's not going to be a negative thing at all. It'll look like the drowning of all flesh, but it's salvation, really. Now, as you build this ark of spiritual understanding, it's going to appear to you as the four square, the matrix structure. That's your ark of spiritual understanding, and all you're doing is to conceive an idea. You're conceiving and housing within this structured spiritual understanding of what your world truly is, as God knows it from everlasting to everlasting. That's what you're doing. That's what we're doing. It's what we're engaged with in Christian Science. Can we see that? I'm just looking at these notes a minute. And in the second tone of spirit as spirit, aren't you finding safety within this structured understanding? If it isn't ordered, if it isn't scientific, if it isn't structured, you see, it's no safety. There's no real substance to it. And so you're finding safety within this understanding, as you just culture the true idea of your world and your universe and yourselves and each other. This is what the spiritual understanding, this firmament of spirit, is all about. And it's going to enable you to demonstrate a new spiritual world. That's right. So that in the third tone, spirit as soul, look at the beauty of it, your ark, the flood is over, the destruction is over, and your ark comes to rest on the top of Mount Ararat, the holy mount. Awfully like the Horeb height where God is revealed, you see. Because what you've got now is a real cornerstone. You've got a capstone. It's that on the top of your mountain. That's what your ark has become to you, the capstone on which to build. Because the textbook will tell you that the cornerstone of all spiritual building is purity. That's what you've done through building this structured understanding and being separated from the from materialism. It simply is a state of spiritual purity on which to build your new world. And it's this beautiful capstone on the top of the pyramid. And a capstone is a capitalization stone. What it really is to you, which you have, with which you have built your ark, what it really is to you, it's the capitalized terms for God. In a calculus, operating in a structured calculus of spiritual understanding. Can you feel the wonder of the, or the promise of it? It isn't easy to put it into words, is it? I can't do it, but if you can just get the feel of it, I don't know. It's so amazing that this is what you're doing when you build your ark, is to build on the capstone of the synonymous terms for God operating in a divine, infinite calculus of ideas, and that is something on which to build. It isn't vague at all, you see. It's so definite and so certain. And so your ark rests on the top of Ararat. And you emerge from the ark. And that just simply means the birth of the world, beginning all over again. You and I have got beginning to get a different sense of our world, aren't we? We're conceiving of it in its spiritual reality, in its spiritual truth. Therefore, you are actually bearing witness to it. I don't know how to put it. Can you feel it? Mm-hmm. It's the tone of spirit as soul. It's the birth of the identity of your world, which is yourself. The second day of creation is the firmament called heaven. My golly. That's where you're working from. The firmament is called heaven. Now, it's the third tone. Well, the great thing is you're making a demonstration in Christian Science, and the great thing is don't be intoxicated by it. Don't believe that you've done it. It's God that's done it. It's spirit as soul that's done it. Because Noah has to teach you a lesson, because he builds a vineyard and gets drunk with the wine. He gets intoxicated, you see, with success. And the great thing is not to be intoxicated with success in this, and it won't be if you give it all back to God instead of taking it personally. And in not only do you not get intoxicated, but you don't build a Tower of Babel, which is the opposite of building the ark. Because what you're doing is to bring to birth a means of understanding whereby all men can begin to understand each other. All men begin to understand a common principle. All men begin to learn a common mother tongue, and therefore to understand one another. This is your ark. In your ark, there is nothing but diversity of identity in unity. That's what your ark consists of. Diversity in unity. what your Tower of Babel consists of is diversity in disunity, which is what your world is suffering from until you understand it in Christian Science. It's all at sixes and sevens and a state of misunderstanding, confusion of tongues. Can we get the touch there of the second period of Noah in its three tones? Yes, a little bit, just touch on it. So let's come into the third period, and the first tone is soul as mind, where Abraham and Isaac feature. Now here's the lovely thing, that Abraham is looking for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Well, you've already started to build that city when your ark landed on the top of Ararat, and you had the cornerstone of all spiritual building, and you really were beginning to build that city. So as you merge into the third period, as Abraham, we're looking for a city which hath foundations. That city is to be your world. The truth about your world, this four-square city. And Abraham, Paul makes it very clear, he almost says, you silly old Abraham, you don't realize that you don't have to look for it. You don't have to make it, you've already got it. You're already it. And the symbol of this city that he's looking for is his wife, Sarah. Because Sarah, says Paul, is Jerusalem above, which is the mother of us all. She represents this city that he's looking for. He doesn't know that he's already got it, that it's already at hand. Look from the place where thou standest, north, south, east, and west, because this is it, God says to him. He thinks he's got to look for it, and he's got to sweat for it, and labor for it, and so on, when in fact he's already got it. And so with Abraham, you get the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, you get the first touch of this city. With Abraham, the word, and then Abraham's son is Isaac, which is a symbol of the Christ. Then, when you come to Jacob, it's a symbol of Christianity, of course, and when you come to Joseph, that's science. No doubt about it. So what he's looking for is what is already at hand in the form of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Can you accept that? It's our first touch. And you come to soul as spirit, which is where Jacob and Joseph begin to feature. Well, that's beautiful. That's beautiful, because Jacob is a Christianity tone, and you can't come to a Christianity tone if you don't come from Abraham to Isaac, then to Jacob. The only way to get Christianity is the word, Christ, Abraham, Isaac. Now you can come to Christianity with Jacob, because of course Jacob is the one who gives birth to the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, who stand for the whole human race. Now I think we'd better just turn the tape over at that point and start again on the other side.